Hello, and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and I'm looking for a fun robot book to read. To help me are my friends, Ian and Joe, two bionic English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I am a high school fully bionic English teacher, and Nick, if you're looking for a fun book to read, you should read We Are Legion by Canadian author Dennis Taylor.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I am a fully replicant high school English teacher. That's a reference to the popular film Blade Runner.
Stupid.
And today, Nick, I think the fun robot book you should read is written by a woman. It's called Metropolis, written by Thea von Harbu, and it's pretty rad.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
So guys, I'm really excited to hear about your robot books. I can't even imagine how difficult they were to read in binary.
But I actually have a comment on this. beep, boop, boop, beep, beep, boop.
Yep. Good.
That's good.
Good.
Also topical.
Joe, do you have a rebuttal?
I don't. I do have a question for Ian. Ian, I have a little bit of meta questions for you this week, right? Had you read this book before this week?
No.
Okay.
I had not.
Neither had I. How long did this book take you to read, and how manageable was this in the time between recordings?
Well, so I
Oh, he's about to say he cheated.
It was a challenge. No, it was
he's
a challenge.
He's about to say he didn't finish the book at all.
I don't know what this book is about. I think it's about robots, but I don't even know.
Is this fun robots, Nick, or happy robots?
It's a fun... No, I don't know. I know. There was no requirement for... fun robots. It has to be a fun book about robots, but the robots themselves can be doer. So,
Ian, you gave yourself probably the most specific window for finding a book I've ever seen, that it kind of makes me wonder if you didn't have the book in mind to begin, like,
no,
first,
dude,
and then you just kind of like beep, just kind of backed into a theme.
I agree. And when
a fun robot book written by a woman,
right?
Like, how many are there?
When you said that, I wasn't sure there was one. Like, when you said, I want to read a fun robot book written by a woman, I thought that might not exist. That might not be possible.
Guess what? It almost doesn't exist, especially given the fact that all libraries are closed and it's hard to like find stuff. I don't have a particularly huge science fiction library here at home.
How many little libraries did you have to go around to?
I walked the dog so goddamn much last week.
I found this book about 45 minutes ago. I think I know what happens, but I'm not sure. No, so it's actually kind of funny. The book that I chose is related to a film I assigned in class recently. So I actually have a good deal of familiarity with
Superman 3.
The story. Yeah, Superman 3, The Quest for Peace. But I had to go questing in the dark spaces of the internet, namely Project Gutenberg, to find a PDF of this book. But it was really, really, really hard to find a fun book about robots. First of all, that's hard.
I like how Ian is just like strong arming his way into going first.
No, I think it's
just
great.
Like, we didn't even know about it. We just kind of like naturally, he just like took over.
Yeah. Great.
Most people who see me just say that I had the strongest of arms. So
my next question, Project Gutenberg, you read an old book. This is an old book?
Ish. I mean, 1925.
Yeah, so, that's pretty old.
I mean, depends on your definition of old, but it's just...
All right, so this book is old. All right, so the movie is pretty iconic. And
yeah.
It's quite famous. Is one of the first kind of like futuristic movies ever made.
Yep. So you, it sounds like you read the Wikipedia article for this.
No, it's just crazy how it was written in tandem with Fritz Lang's 1927 film of the same name.
It actually wasn't written in tandem with it. It was written before it.
I think everybody's ready for you to just go first. Ian, can you tell us about what book you picked? Now, for people that don't know, we pick out books that Ian has already read and assign a theme, a very specific and broad theme to them.
And then we force Joe to read a book somewhat related to it.
Ian has actually never read a book yet.
It took me all weekend, Joe. I was reading like hundreds of pages a day. All right, so you guys can't mock me when I pronounce the author's name, the name of the author, because I'm going to pronounce it in the German fashion because she was German. Oh, boy. Those promises are worth practically nothing to me because I met you. So the book is Metropolis, and it's written by Thea van Harbo. Or if you want to be crass, you could say Thea van Harbo, but who would want that?
I'm 25% German, so I think that is correct.
Joe,
are you German at all?
I am largely German.
Ian, are you German? Are you German at all?
I am of the Germanic persuasion, yes.
Just three Germans talking about old literature.
Oh, boy. Ways to get this podcast canceled.
Sorry to cut you off.
You just keep cutting me off.
Again.
Okay, I can tell you what the book is about if you want.
Let's do it.
I would really enjoy that.
Okay. So in one sentence, the book is about the meaning and cost of humanity in a mechanized world.
Okay. Try two sentences now.
Okay. Well, can I tell you about the characters first?
Wait, try zero sentences and then one sentence and then zero sentences and then like
and then one sentence. One,
yeah. One, like zero. One sentence.
Whenever you're ready, I'll tell you about some of the characters in this book, but I'll just wait. I'll wait until you're ready for that. Just give me the go ahead. Are you good? You ready? Here we go. We have an inventor with a metal arm.
I'm ready.
Okay. This is good audio. This is comedic, engaging literary audio right here.
Ian, I'm sorry. I'm listening patiently, Ian.
I know, Joe, you are a saint. There is an inventor. He has a metal arm. His name is Rotwang. I'm going to spell that. Yeah, I thought that would get a little chuckle out of some of you. Gutter snipes. The cold, hyper-intelligent mayor of the town that all this stuff is set in. Town is called Metropolis. And his name is Joe.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, there it is. Excellent. There it is. I would say...
The town is called Metropolis?
Yeah, dude. It's a little bit... So, this is an interesting book. Yeah, it's a science fiction book which has strong elements of the fable to it, which is
what
fun.
Fable?
There is another character that I can tell you about. This is Maria. Maria is a beautiful woman who has remarkable persuasive power and is generally just like the best. It's hard to root for characters in this book because of reasons, but she is like, you can always root for her because she's like good. Joe, the mayor, has a son who is idealistic and high strung. His name is Fredder. And then there is the robot. And the robot doesn't have a name as such. Rotwang is the inventor.
His name is Metropolis.
Oh, no. Everything is named Metropolis. The inventor whose name is Metropolis names the robot Metropolis. The robot is referred to by the inventor as Parody because she is a parody of humanity. He also calls her Futura. So, inventor, mayor, Maria, who's the beautiful love interest, the main character, the high-strung son, and the robot. Those are the main characters. And the story is relatively straightforward. So hang with me here. It's only about 20 minutes long.
Okay, great. Perfect.
Here we go. So Fredder, our main character, falls in love with Maria. And he discovers that the working class in this city, Metropolis, view her as a quasi-divine spiritual leader. So naturally, Joe, the mayor, and Rotwang, the inventor, capture Maria and steal her image and duplicate her image onto the robot that Rotwang is inventing. They send this robot out into the world to corrupt everyone, not just the workers, but also the wealthy classes. And the robot succeeds in making everyone sort of follow her and love her and want her. And Joe reveals later that he's doing this in order to destroy the city, to pit workers against wealthy. So Fredder can take over and rebuild the city and establish his reputation. It's this whole like father sacrificing himself for his son. But predictably, this extremely complex, far too intricate plan fails because the workers discover that they have been tricked and they burn Maria, the robot Maria, the robot version. And then they get in a huge like benches clearing brawl with the wealthy classes.
I have a question.
Yeah.
You say they steal her image. Like, do they steal her? Is it her personality inside of like a metallic shiny robot, or is she an android for all intents and purposes? Like, does she appear as Maria?
She is physically indistinguishable from Maria. So when you look at her and when you hear her talk, she is the robot Maria, to all intents and purposes, is indistinguishable from Maria. Now, and the things that she says,
charisma and things like that.
Yeah,
as well.
Right. That, and this is key. Perhaps even more charisma, because she is able to get everyone just to like almost supernaturally fall in love with her, follow her, desire her. And
is this as you're reading this, Ian? Yeah. Now, this book's super old, and it. When is it supposed to take place?
It's supposed to take place in about 6 years from now, 2026. So
is this like one of those really, I don't know, how does it age? It feels like it could be one of those books that's like it's about the future and there's like flying cars. How does it hold up?
To be honest, it actually is. It's pretty evergreen. One of the things that Von Harbo does is dial down the sort of hyper futurism in favor of observing humanity. And so I said at the beginning that this is a story about the meaning and cost of humanity in a mechanized world. And a few elements of it are somewhat dated, but a lot of it is really, really prescient, really has a lot of foresight.
Like, what's the point of the book?
I told you, dog.
He did it in one sentence, right?
I told you at the top. The book is interested. The book is really interested in like what it means to be human. So it was created in the 1920s when mechanization. So this is when Henry Ford is really getting into the assembly line, not just as a model for producing things, but as a mindset, the assembly line mindset. And this is a time when people are increasingly wondering, what does it mean to be a human? So the first like metal functioning robot was built around this time in the 1927, I want to say 28, somewhere in there. The word robot entered the English language in 1921. So this is a time when people are really concerned with, wait, maybe there are humanoids which are not human. So the book is interested in this question of what does it mean to be human? Is it worth anything to be human? These are kind of common questions for robot books, if we're being honest. Mm-hmm. Like, if you've got a book about robots, it's going to ask, what does it mean to be human? What's the difference between a human and a robot?
You know, I think it's interesting that you talk about the assembly line, because I can imagine if you're living in this time and all of a sudden you went from a world where things are built by craftsmen, mm-hmm. right? People who had studied their entire lives, people who had like dedicated their lives in order to creating this perfect chair or yeah. whatever it is. And all of a sudden they become a cog in literally a machine,
yeah.
right? I really do think moments like that in history, you can see the spike of something like science fiction or robot books, because moments like that in history, I think absolutely make you ask, hey, what the hell am I doing here? Like, am I just a cog in a machine? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. And the book plays on this question of people who have been trained by the sort of assembly line mindset that they are just cogs in the machine. And one of the things that Robot Maria does is teach them to break out.
Tell us more about Robot Maria.
Dude, she's messed up. Can I read you a quote? A really freaky quote about her.
Is it binary?
I cannot speak binary. I'm sorry.
Is it in binary?
It's no, it's not. This joke is okay. Old already. This joke is older than this book.
I would like to hear a quote.
It's a really freaky quote. I love this quote. It's just the novel doesn't really lend itself to sort of these one-liner aphorisms about the world or art being useless. It's much more sort of in the moment imagistic. It's got shades of expressionism, which you see much more in the film, which was adapted from this book. But this is the moment when Joe, the mayor, meets Rotwang's robot. And this is before they put Maria's face on the robot. This is before they make her in the image of Maria. So the robot is still...
Why did they choose to use her face?
Because she's so persuasive. And that she's so like, she's so powerful. They can tell that she has she already has an in with the working class, and she's also beautiful. So they're like, the wealthy will love her too. So this is what how Von Harbaugh describes it. Suddenly, Joe felt from the back a certain coldness approaching him. Involuntarily, he held his breath. A hand grasped along by his head, a graceful skeleton hand. Transparent skin was stretched over the slender joints, which gleamed beneath it like dull silver. Fingers, snow white and fleshless, closed over the plan which lay on the table, and lifting it up, took it away with it. Joe swung around. He stared at the being which stood before him with eyes which grew glassy. The being was, indubitably, a woman. In the soft garment which it wore stood a body, like the body of a young birch tree, swaying on feet set fast together. But, although it was a woman, it was not human. The body seemed as though made of crystal, through which the bones shone silver. Cold streamed from the glazen skin, which did not contain a drop of blood. The being held its beautiful hands pressed against its breast, which was motionless, with a gesture of determination, almost of defiance. But the being had no face. The beautiful curve of the neck bore a lump of carelessly shaped mass. The skull was bald. Nose, lips, temples merely traced. Eyes, as though painted on closed lids, stared unseeingly with an expression of calm madness at the man who did not breathe.
Wow. So that's such a cool description, because you get like you get kind of this juxtaposition of like this beautiful feminine like thing in here, but it's also just totally cold and lifeless. And like the notes that I have here say like it's haunting, right? Like that is a haunting description of this thing.
Terrifying. And like, I love how like you're saying, it is presented with these positive words, graceful, like words like slender joints or snow white fingers. These are like good things. These are positive descriptions of beauty. But as we sort of like look at her with Joe, as we process her, as Joe processes her, we're realizing just how inhuman, how terrifying this is. And the line about cold streaming from her glazing skin, this is another thing that when the robot touches people, she is preternaturally cold. She is impossibly cold. Joe, you're probably familiar with this. There is a long-standing tradition in poetry and prose, mostly written by dudes, about a tradition of describing a woman from the bottom up, like from her feet up. It's called a blazon.
And I think it is so nice that you assume I am familiar with that. I've never heard this before in my life.
Okay, well, maybe it's a Shakespeare thing.
Tell us about it.
Okay,
Ian.
So here's the thing. This is a habit. Like I say, it's almost always done by male authors, and it's kind of an objectifying move where women are described from like feet to head or head to feet, but it's very, very sensual. There's usually like a little joke about, and I'm not going to tell you what's around the waist because it's so beautiful. But
we know.
Yes, Nick, we do know.
You know, you can even I can even imagine like an actress being portrayed like that on film, right?
Yes.
Like, I feel like we start with like right at the feet, we get the camera on as it pans up and we see the hips and the breasts and we see like the ultimately the face.
Right.
Yeah. Really cool.
Right. So this is something which is picked up in film terminology. With this story, with this quote, with this section, Von Harbaugh is a woman, and she is existing, writing in a kind of misogynist context. And the film, if you've seen the film of Metropolis, it does do this kind of blazon move, this pan a couple of times. But what she does with this is she starts it off with a positive blazon. Oh, we're like, oh, her feet are like a young birch tree. The body is made of crystal, silver. Its hands are pressed against its breast. And then we get to the face, and the face is hellish. The face is nightmarish. It's a lump of carelessly shaped mass. The neck is beautiful, and the head is just like, imagine like Play-Doh, just like kind of scrumbled together and slapped on top of, like, you know, Greek sculpture.
You just said you recently watched the movie, Ian. What's the difference? Is there big differences?
Yes, there are differences. So the novel was not published as a novelization of the film. It was published before the film was released. It was published serially, So every week or every month, a new section would come out. And it was published with stills from the film, which was in production while it was while the book was being published. So it has this kind of interesting relationship with the film.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I've never really heard about like a book and a film like simultaneously coming out at the same time, like
especially
that.
Because she didn't write von Harbo didn't write a screenplay. She didn't write a treatment. She wrote a whole dang book, which they then adapted into a screenplay for the film. Mm-hmm. So it's like an extra step, which honestly seems kind of unnecessary to me. Usually nowadays, original ideas are turned into screenplays. Like if you have an original idea, you write the screenplay and then it's, mm-hmm. It's not an adaptation.
Sure.
And so the relationship between the book and the film is actually similar in terms of some of the plot details. I mean, you've got your Rotwang, you've got your Fredder, Joe, the robot Maria is there. But the book emphasizes different elements, and the book's ending is quite different from the film. The movie's great, but I think I may maybe prefer the book because the book is more hopeful.
I feel like whenever you read like these older books where I don't know, it's about like some sort of post-apocalyptic or like it's some take on the future, it's always just so on the nose regarding like how they interpret the future and like just talking about humanity in general,
like perhaps didactic, trying to teach a lesson. It has a strong, like, it's got a moral at the end, and the moral is don't be evil to your workers, and also don't try and murder a whole bunch of people so that your son can have an empire.
I feel like, Joe, Ian made such a big deal about picking a female author, but hasn't really talked about her much.
Yeah.
Ian, can you tell us a little bit about the author?
Yeah. So I picked the book because I enjoyed the film, and I wanted to see what the book would do different from the film. The author was a longtime writing partner of Fritz Lang, who was a well-known, super popular film director.
Mm-hmm.
Harbo and Lang were married, and they were collaborators for.
Wait, seriously? Yeah. Oh, that's like a huge important detail. So she was married to the director of the film.
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand. Are you kind of passing a little judgment there, Nick?
No, I just can't believe you didn't bring it up earlier as we were talking about the connections between the book and the film.
Oh, okay,
it's actually quite fucking shocking.
I'm not going to like lead with here is the woman and here is the man she's married to. It's mm-hmm. much more like, what did she do? So yes, they were married, and they were solid.
Only a sexist could make this connection.
I think honestly, I'm much more interested in the book than in Harbo, but it is interesting. Yeah. It is cool that she and Lang worked together a lot. She was a very, very prolific writer. She did a little bit on the kind of the film side, but she did a lot of writing treatments for his films. He had this reputation as I can't even think. Like you're maybe like a Martin Scorsese, one of these who's
Scorsese.
Thank you. Thank you. Were you doing the little thing with your hands as you said that?
No.
No? Nothing? Okay. He was just this titan. And part of the reason he was so respected was because she was this incredibly inventive, creative writer who would come up with these outlandish situations. I mean, this story holds up almost 100 years later. He was Jewish, and she was not. And this is kind of a black mark on her.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, here we go. So,
uh-oh.
Yeah, oh yeah. No, you know where this is going.
I don't like the timeline of this, actually.
No, you don't. No, here we go. So,
I'm super concerned.
1920s, Weimar Republic in uh-huh. Germany. Lots of
everything
money.
Looking good.
Everything was going interestingly. Lang and von Harbo are this power couple. They make Metropolis. They make another movie called M. They have this trilogy that they're working on. They're really cutting edge, pushing the boundaries. And then, as you know, in 1933, the Nazis come to power in Germany. And Joseph Goebbels brought the Nazi minister of propaganda, brought Lang into his office and said, "Hey, man, I respect you a lot, but we cannot release your latest movie because it presents people overthrowing their government. And we don't want that. But we would love, Mr. Lang, we'd love for you to keep working for us Nazis doing propaganda." And Lang said, "Let me just go check something in Paris quick." And then he fled. because, you know, he was of Jewish extraction and he kind of could see the writing on the wall. Unfortunately, his good wife, Thea, stayed.
Oh, she stayed. No. And,
oh, yes. She got involved. She got involved in doing Nazi propaganda. And she stopped. She stopped not because she had
good money.
She stopped not because she had a crisis of conscience, but because it was bad for the art. They were not letting her do her art as she wanted. So, I mean, I guess
she lost creative control. I hear a lot of people lost creative control during that time
but
period.
Give her a chance.
They lost a lot of things.
Ian, so do you think it's safe to say that Harborough was just a terrible person?
I don't. Clearly, she was a coward. She went along with the Nazis, which is pretty cowardly. I mean, you got to define cowardly. It's right there. No, I think this is actually a really interesting question. And
sounds like we have a little sympathizer on this podcast.
Joe, I'm sure you deal with this. With your
students. Joe into this.
The question of what do we do with the art of people who are bad?
Yeah, the art of problematic people.
Yeah, right. And like, okay, so what do we do with von Harbu, who at the time of writing this novel was not a Nazi, but since became a Nazi. There's one school of thought which says throw it all out. There's another school of thought which says it doesn't matter if the author is a horrible person. I think I fall somewhere in the middle. When the author is potentially horrible, potentially racist, potentially supporting fascism, I tend to read what they create with a grain of salt. So there is a passage in this novel, sort of a subplot. There's a nightclub.
No. Are there a lot of subplots?
Not many.
Uh-huh.
The subplot is basically that there's a drug which allows you to feel
supreme.
No, no.
Are there any solutions in this? How do I say big, this? Does the book offer up any solutions?
Any like just big a solutions.
Yeah, anything big or grand or final. Yeah. In some sort of way.
If you try and look at it, this goes back to the picture of Dorian Gray, which if you haven't listened to that episode, you should go listen to it. Art existing in a vacuum. Like, it doesn't. It exists in history. And this is one of the things that Joe is riding the wave on well. By choosing recent books, there is no history, so it's fine. But like when you look at books which are steeped in history, whose authors then go on to, you know, make propaganda for the Nazis, you have to say, okay, do we cancel this book? Is this book over? We don't read it anymore.
Yes, canceled. That goes back to the point though of like, I don't know. Whenever you have a book written about like the future or a movie about the future, I feel like you have to look at what was going on at the time that it was written.
100%.
Because I think that plays such a big role in the story.
Yeah.
Like
you can't look at it outside its context.
I think it's just it plays such a big part.
Well, but I mean, I don't know. I think there is some credence to be given to this. But I mean, at the same time, I think if you say art is a product of its environment, right? These stories are a product of their environment. That's not a particularly surprising thing to say. Like that shouldn't shock us so much, right? Like we look at like people are a product of their environment, right? And like when you talk about, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I'm
concerned about where you're going with this.
I think that my question for you then, Joe, would be like, is it possible if art is the books, if books are the product of their contexts, is it possible for a book to have value beyond the value of its contexts? So is it possible for this book, which has this context of sort of social unrest and expressionism and the Bauhaus movement in art, and also the rise of the Nazi Party and von Harbo's eventual involvement with the Nazis, is it as valuable as that stuff? Which is to say, maybe not super valuable? Or is it greater than a sum of its parts?
I think, here's the thing. I think, is it more valuable than like the stuff that it's maybe allegory for? And allegory is not the right word here, but this book comes out of this turbulent time. This book comes out of a time where we're talking about workers' rights, where we have fascist parties rising to power. That stuff still is valuable, right? So like, just because this book is written by somebody who is, would become inside the Nazi party, the stuff and the human condition that they're talking about is still super valuable. I mean, even going back to talking about, we get this rise in science fiction when people start feeling like cogs in the machine. I think a lot of white collar workers can identify today, not, let alone blue collar workers, let alone like non-skilled trades, right? I think a lot of workers, period, today can identify with the feeling of being a cog in a machine. Anybody who has ever worked in a cubicle, right, has felt like that at some point. So I think like that meaning, if we're talking about this book is literature, I think that meaning is absolutely still there, and that value is still there regardless of that context.
Yeah, I think I would agree. And I think the challenge then becomes, how do you talk about it? How do you frame it? So if I were to assign this book to my students, I could not assign it as simply a science fiction story, simply a fun robot book written by a woman. I would have to assign it as a text of modernism, of expressionism, of early science fiction, of something that's involved in the sort of the growing industry of film production, and also something which is tapping into potentially fascist ideologies. And you gotta frame it. You gotta say, like, this is what this thing is, because otherwise you get into this sort of dangerous area of claiming that the art can transcend. I don't think that's what you're arguing, but like art is perhaps more valuable than its contexts, and it's valuable on a higher level, but it's also connected to those contexts. And if we sever that connection, then we start letting all kinds of like nasty stuff slip past our filter.
Are you guys at all concerned about how much I'm going to censor you in the edit?
It's like, wow, Ian's part was only like 4 minutes long. It felt longer.
But thank you for bringing your Nazi book to the table, Ian. That was very fun read. Joe, tell us about your anti-Nazi book.
Yeah, so I wouldn't characterize this book as necessarily anti-Nazi.
Again, that's a concerning caveat there.
It's not overt in its opposition to the Nazi party.
You are either pro or against. So which one is it?
All right.
How do you
read this book? So I think this book's going to be, it might be interesting to talk about here, because I think we've pushed the boundaries. And I think like part of what we've done here is kind of push the boundaries of talking about what qualifies as literature. And I read a book this week that I think is not literature, right? Like, I think it is just okay. Straight up. Like, if like this book, you know, Ian's book is written in 1927, Ian?
25.
1925. This book is written in 2016, and there is no chance we are reading this book 100 years from now. Like that is absolutely not going to happen.
I love that honesty. That's good honesty.
How do you define literature?
Well, that's a big question. I don't think I want to get into that, but I do think what I did here is, I don't know if it's unlike Ian. I found a fun robot book this week. My book is called We Are Legion. It is written by a guy named Dennis Taylor, and it was published in 2016. It is the greatest hits of sci-fi situations, is what I would describe this book as.
Ooh.
Yeah. Let me tell you.
Keep on coming.
And the hits do keep on coming. And I think the narrative structure that the author uses really is clever and lends itself towards this kind of greatest hits, almost montage. I'll get to that in just a second. First, a few fun facts about the author.
I love it.
Yeah. Dennis Taylor was Nazi. Before he, yeah. Dennis Taylor was a computer programmer when he wrote this book, and writing was very much a hobby of his. And like, I feel like we've heard this story over and over and over again with writers. He couldn't find a publisher for his science fiction stories. So in the age of the internet, he self-published this novel initially. It picked up a little bit of traction. It got a lot of positive reviews, and then it got picked up. I think you'll like this, Nick. Okay. It got picked up by Audible as an Audible original, and Audible threw a lot of money at it and really gave it a fantastic audiobook edition that a lot of people swear by. Like when you read threads.
Yeah. I really only have good things to say about Audible. Like when I, you know, if I'm going to read a book, it'll be an Audible book.
This podcast brought to you by Audible.
All right.
So it's an Audible original. Joe, tell us about it.
It was, I would say, a really fast, fun read. I think I probably started reading this book maybe Sunday, maybe even Monday, and I finished it this afternoon. And I thought it was really enjoyable. It was quick. It was breezy. The chapters, Nick, were really short and punchy. They're quick to get through. I think ultimately there ended up being something like 65 chapters, 68 chapters in this thing. But a lot of those were two minutes long. I mean, less even some of them. Some of them were just a page long. I think one of the fun things about this book, well, let me actually back up. Let me give you a very brief plot overview. This book starts in present day, and it is a guy who is he's like a Silicon Valley tech bro, is essentially what he is. And he hits it big. He sells his company to a larger company. He has this huge payday. And the very first thing he does is sign up for a service that will cryogenically freeze his head after his death. Sweet. With the idea being that he will be resuscitated someday when the technology is ripe for him to essentially be put inside of a robot. Well,
okay. How much would you guys ever do this?
Oh, dude, the guy is so shady. There's like one dude who is behind.
How rich would you have to be to freeze your body?
I don't think you freeze your body. Do you freeze your body?
No, I think, well, I...
Why would you just freeze the head? Why not get the whole arms and legs in there? You don't want those when you come back?
I think it becomes a storage issue.
So I think I know where this is going. He just fully expects he's going to turn into a robot one day.
Yeah, like that's his plan. He's like, someday
no need for the body.
That's exactly it. Like someday I will be reawoken, right? It might be 20 years in the future. It might be 1,000 years in the future, but will be reawoken.
Yeah. Don't wake me up unless there's a robot body you can put this head on.
Does he like say, wake me up when September ends?
He doesn't. He says, this will be interesting when it pays off someday, is this little small bet that I've made, if it pays off someday.
That's my other favorite Green Day song.
Hey, Nick, could you just, sorry to jump in, could you just list them in order, all of your favorite Green Day songs?
This company will freeze your body for $200,000.
Wow. Your body or your head?
Full body.
I'm sorry, Joe, I wasn't listening. I'm sorry. Is there a promise? Is there a promise that he will be put on a robot body, or is this his idea?
No, this
cut to the chase, Joe. Where's the robot body?
This is super vague when it starts out. Like he essentially just says, "Hey, I have a ton of money. I have more money than I know what to do with. One of the things I'm going to do is just throw some money down in case this pays off."
Sounds like a really likable guy.
Yeah, it's almost like buying a lottery ticket, right? It's like, hey, here's a small bet. It might pay off big. You can imagine what happens next.
Not really.
2 days later, he gets hit by a car, right? Like just absolutely gets smoked in the streets of San Francisco.
Wow.
Okay.
That is incredibly good timing.
He wakes up 117 years later, and he wakes up to a world that has totally changed. He wakes up in America, or like what America has become, and America has become this ultra theocratic, like heavy-handed bureaucratic, I don't want to say dictatorship, but along those levels. Like it is like a theocratic authoritarian government. And he finds himself in the heart of this space race because...
Wait, which space race is this? I'm sorry.
It's the new space race. Humans have developed for the first time ever deep space technology.
Oh, no.
Technology to go interstellar between like approaching light speeds. However, they need artificial intelligence to run the machines, and they go and tap into these cryogenically frozen humans to like train as replicants. And he is chosen for this mission. So he is the United States representative. They essentially turn him into a replicant. They turn him into a software program. They load him into a spaceship, which is essentially his body at that point, and they blast him into the stars. That's the premise of this book.
Wait, so Joe, are you saying that the robot
Your fun robot book is a spaceship.
Actually, when it starts, he's just like essentially on a thumb drive and they load him into different bodies. They load him into like the security cameras. Yeah, they load him into like the security cameras in the test facility. They give him like little test bodies to see if he can like move his arms and legs.
They turn him into that little paperclip that's on the side Clippy. Of your
document. He turns into Clippy and he helps you make a resume.
But he becomes a spaceship. Sorry, I derailed you. Go ahead.
No, you're totally fine. He becomes a spaceship. One of the things, he gets blasted into the stars and his job is to self-replicate. So he goes to the stars and through like mining materials from planets and asteroids and through 3D printing at the molecular level, he starts to create copies of himself to go out and further explore the stars. So we get this doubling effect that happens with these replicants, right? It starts out with just this one replicant, Bob, his name is. He goes out to the stars and then he starts making copies of himself. And
those copies, like,
no, it's not.
B-O-B?
It's short for Robert, actually, in this case.
This is a character from the 1992 television show Twin Peaks.
Bob. Is he really like creepy and angry looking?
Does he have long gray hair? I have a question. A serious question.
Yeah.
So this is something which I saw in doing what they call opposition research for this podcast, this episode. I saw this book and the other books in the Bobiverse.
Yeah, it's a terrible name. Yeah. If you didn't want to talk about Nazis, I didn't want to talk about the word Bobiverse.
Well, I mean, it's a bit different and whatever. I saw this book and the other books in the Bobiverse referred to as hard science lit. So is the science hard? How hard is the science? That's my question.
Yeah, super good question. So Nick, do you know what we mean if we say like hard science fiction?
I've seen The Martian, so I think I know what you're getting at.
Yeah, like it's.
He have to grow plants from his poop?
Okay, so. Ian, I saw that description as well of this as hard science fiction. I thought that was probably a generous description of this book. I mean, I will say it does make an attempt to solve the problems that interstellar travel would solve. However, I do think that some of it, and it tries to like have a plausible explanation in order to solve those problems. However, I do think it turns a little bit hand-wavy at times. What happens as these guys split up? One of the ways that it becomes this this greatest hits of science fiction is as these different Bobs go throughout the universe, they all encounter different situations. And what you end up with is a variety of point of view chapters from one clone to another clone to another clone to another clone. And the way to tell these chapters apart is by what is happening in the chapters. So we end up with all these clones going into the universe. And one of the challenges that this causes is the reader needs a way to tell these clones apart. So I've got a little game for us.
I love the games.
One of the things the clones do, one of the very first things they do is they get to name themselves. And because this guy is presumably kind of a nerd in real life, all these clones name themselves something a little bit nerdy. What I want to do is I want to give you the clone's name and I want to tell you and I want you to guess what franchise or what it's a reference to. So, for example,
this is testing our nerd knowledge.
You're testing your nerd knowledge. Right. And I think you'll pass this test with flying colors.
OK,
For example.
Hold on. Ian, yes. Are you ready?
I guess this is not going to go well for me. Fair warning.
I think I'm going to do pretty good. I watch a lot of. What's that one show?
Arrow.
Is that
Arrow.
One really?
Arrow on the CW.
Yeah, it's definitely on CW. All right, I'm ready.
Okay. First one's easy. One of the first clones names himself Mario.
Wow, this is... Okay, didn't think this was going to be a stupid game.
I like this second game.
This was going to be like a fun game that we could, you know, maybe has some obstacles.
I'm curious if you get this one, because I would call the next one low-hanging fruit. The next one names himself Riker.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Ian, did you have anything funny to say?
I was trying to remember. There's an island. There's a Rikers Island. It's a reference to the island, the prison. Yeah, I got that one.
There is a Rikers Island, but he is named after Captain Picard's number one officer, Commander Riker.
Oh, Star Wars. Trek. Star Wars, I got you.
So these, got it. Is there, okay, let's just cut to the any slightly more difficult ones here.
You got it wrong.
Yeah, Star Trek.
Okay.
Great, it's number two.
Okay.
Do you want to answer these?
Yeah, absolutely. Linus.
The programming software.
Ooh, next. Such a good guess. Actually, the really Peanuts character.
That's a good guess. I like that, though, because he was a computer programmer, right? Mine's
nerdier.
Yeah, it is nerdier, but...
So, are we playing a game of out-nerd the Dennis? I think we are.
Yeah, I just out-nerded this book.
All right.
Give me a harder one.
Mulder.
Mulder and Scully.
Next. Luke.
Star Wars?
Yep, good. Bender.
Futurama.
All right, I've got one that I do not think you will get, Ian. I think you might. Marvin.
Oh, I got this one.
Marvin Gaye.
Yeah.
Not Marvin Gaye, Ian. What is it?
It's from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's the Sad
it
Robot.
It is from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That is the book I almost chose this week, but I realized it had to be. I realized it had
ironically,
to be a fun robot
book.
Ironically,
the only one
book.
I couldn't get was a book.
I don't think that's ironic at all, Dick.
Okay.
There's a few more, but
that was
but,
a fun game. We should play that again sometime.
I think that was a good game.
I'd like more games in this.
Yeah, I think it was pretty good.
My game can be called, can you guess if this person is a Nazi sympathizer?
That's fun. Let me go first.
Books written in 1927.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's very useful in this book and keeping track of things in your mind is as the other clones replicate from that initial one, they will all take names for the most part in the same family. So for example, all of Bill the Cat's clones are named some sort of cartoon character, right? Some sort of animated character. So we get like Homer, for example, is one of his clones. Goku is one of his clones. Linus is one of his clones. Kelvin is one of his clones. And I thought that was just kind of a clever thing that the author did to keep things on track in your mind.
You're right. This book won't be read in 100 years.
No,
I think it's really interesting.
And do you know what it reminded me of?
Sorry. I was just gonna like pick up on that 100 years thing. My when I did my PhD, I studied stuff from 400 years ago, Shakespeare's time. Anyway, when we study stuff from Shakespeare's time, a lot of it like just is gone because of fires, because if it was used up. So anything we have, even the kind of most flimsy, crappy paperback stuff, is useful because it gives us insight on the history of the culture, like what the culture was like at that time, what their memes were, what their in-jokes were. So I understand what you're saying, Joe, and perhaps on literary merit, this book might not be worth reading in 100 years as a piece of fine art, but it sounds like it's got a lot of pop culture references.
So I would say the book it reminded me of more is actually Ready Player One. And I think that the nerd references aren't quite as heavy-handed as Ready Player One. The narrator actually is also, we get a voice kind of similar to The Martian, kind of similar to Ready Player One, where it's almost that detached, slightly ironic, maybe sarcastic, kind of snarky first-person narrator. So I do think like these books belong in a family with one another. One of the interesting things that happens in this book is as clones replicate, they are technically software. Right. That's what these clones are. I guess maybe they're like a firmware or something like that.
We don't really have to get into
the specific coding. Are they hardware?
How were they developed? What program Linux. Were they written in Linus? Yes. Linus. So, Joe, let's cut to the chase. So they take over the universe. Clearly, we know where this is going. They take over the universe with their spreading.
Man spreading.
As they call it. Their robot spreading.
Bob spreading.
Then what happens? Anything interesting or cool?
So as they explore the universe, I think there's a couple interesting things. One of their first jobs is to find a planet for humans to move to. That's one of the jobs of these replicants.
Classic.
Come to a planet. Like, we need basically a plan B for planet Earth. Another Bob finds a civilization, but very low level, like very primitive. Like, they have just recently discovered how to tie flint and shape rock and put it on the ends of spears. And you get this cool situation because this species, this people is being hunted to extinction by a predator, but an animalistic predator. So like a non-intelligence predator. And Bob
has to decide whether or not to interfere. Nick, what do you think he does?
He probably interferes. I don't know.
Yeah, he totally interferes, which I loved.
Like Star Trek.
Well, I feel like when I would watch Star Trek when I was younger, you always hear about the Prime Directive. It's one of the things that was always a plot point on Star Trek.
And Joe, what is the Prime Directive?
Yeah, the Prime Directive.
First, do no harm.
Yep, that's it. You got it. The Prime Directive in Star Trek is just this idea that you are not allowed to contact civilizations. I think it's like civilizations who have not discovered warp technology yet, but essentially they draw a line of sophistication for a civilization, and spacefaring civilizations are not allowed to contact or interfere in the lives of people who have not yet crossed that line. So when in Star Trek they come across primitive peoples,
monkey planets,
thank you, they do what they can to back off of those monkey planets.
The primate directive. Perfect.
So one of the moments I love in this book, Bob does decide to interfere for the good of this species. And we get this really cool, we start to see him interact with this species. And it's very biblical in its allusions. Like, he goes and speaks to one of them. And so as to not freak him out, he like disguises himself as one of the plants, right? And he tells himself
that's the Jesus. Kind of thing that doesn't freak someone out. It's a plant with arms and legs.
So in this religious undertone, he disguises himself as a plant.
Yep.
And talks to another civilization.
Yeah. So people are dressed up as plants.
Yeah. So maybe I should call this game
just a play on Bible verse. Is this all like the Bible?
Dang, Nick, that's good. That is some hardcore literary criticism right there.
Do you think?
I do.
Thank you, Ian.
You're welcome.
I mean, you're a doctor, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, so I'm not going to go into the story here, but because one of the things that's interesting is Bob, the guy who became this replicant, he is fallible. Like, he is a man. Like, his consciousness is that of a man's. He is not hyper intelligent. However, he is hooked up to like this mainframe where he has all of the information he could ever want, but he is not infallible by any means. So when he has to make a decision.
Like Alexa.
Yeah. I don't know. He's smarter. He's smarter than Alexa.
Okay.
When he has to make these decisions, he is not doing it with the assuredness that he's making the correct decision. However, these primitive people, seeing that from their point of view, an omnipotent, omnipresent being coming down to their planet and saying, hey, you got to get out of this place. I can help you. It really does feel like intervention from the gods. So you get these cool moments in this book like that.
Hey, Joe, can I hop in quick with a quote? Not from my book, but a quote I was going to bring up when I was talking about Metropolis. And it sounds like it directly applies to this.
Is it from Mein Kampf?
No, my gosh. No, it's from the well-known science fiction author and futurist Arthur C. Clarke. He had three laws of science fiction, and the third is probably the most well-known and frequently cited. The third law of science fiction is that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah.
And it kind of sounds like we're seeing it from these cultures' point of view. Bob, in all of his manifold forms, is magical, even though we know it's just sufficiently advanced technology.
And I think we see the totally other end of this spectrum, where in this book, a different replicant, a different clone, goes to a different solar system, a different star system, and he runs into a massively advanced civilization, or at least the remnants of a massively advanced civilization.
It's Tim.
With technology that absolutely puts theirs to shame. And it is a very dangerous thing. And we get like this full swing of the pendulum from we are omnipotent godlike creatures to we are nothing and we are going to be destroyed by this greater power.
I feel like I don't even care what happens. This book sounds like so much fun.
It's so fun. Nick, there is space war. A very common thing that happens in here is they have to fight these little space battles, like these little space skirmishes against maybe other
among
replicants.
The stars?
Among the stars, in asteroid fields, among like other replicants from other civilizations that got off the planet. So when I say this is the greatest hits of science fiction, it really is. You just get like these little glimpses and these little focusing lenses at all these classic sci-fi scenarios where each one of these Bobs has to deal with these moments. And it ends up being just a really fun, quick, fun, breezy read.
I've done a lot of listening. I'd like to do a little bit of talking.
Yes.
I mean, to think that Ian could win today is just like, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I don't think so either.
Nick, I understand that. I understand that, that mindset. And to some extent, I didn't know that she was a Nazi when I finished it.
When you started talking?
I didn't know this until...
until this podcast started?
I did not know this until after I finished the book and I was doing research on it. I was like, oh, dang. Well, here we go.
Oops, it's a Nazi.
But officer, I didn't know she was a Nazi.
As somebody who reads a lot of books, how often does that happen?
You give people enough time and they'll always turn out terrible. So like, I think Nazis...
Time makes a Nazi of us all.
Yes. That's Shakespeare.
That's perfect. Yeah. Time makes a Nazi of us all.
I understand and I accept my inevitable demise here, but I think it would be valuable for us to think about like what's acceptable.
maybe we should stop. Maybe you should play the outro music.
The podcast off now. Yeah.
When I was bringing this book in, Ian, I really did think like this might give us a chance to talk about like what do we mean when we talk about lit here? Because like if I have to hit certain criteria, if we have to hit certain criteria, and one of them is your book is literature, I think I'm disqualified this week. I didn't know that going into it. I was looking for like a fun robot book, but I almost feel like a fun robot book almost by definition is not going to be of much literary merit.
That's bullshit.
I don't agree. I'm sorry. I'm gonna go to fantasy for this.
We both disagree with you.
It's possible. No, I think it's an interesting claim, but I think it's very possible for like extremely fun stuff to also be quote unquote literature highbrow. Like,
I'd like to read you the definition of literature according to.
Hey, look at Urban Dictionary. Give us the Urban Dictionary definition of literature, please.
Okay, hold on.
Anything?
No, I don't believe him. I don't believe whatever he's about to say.
Anything written in print that's not Twilight.
I love it.
That's pretty good. That's not bad.
I like it.
Can we end the show on that? Joe, read us off in German, please.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to read you off in German.
Okay. All right, just do English then.
Yep, I'm just going to do English. You just need the slightest bit of context for this. So when he was blasted off by the United States of America, he was like very much of the property of the United States of America. And as such, he was programmed with override codes. So when they return to Earth, he's sorting out this post-apocalyptic mess. All of these different survivors come from different factions, and the faith faction, the faction from the United States of America, or what was the United States of America, is trying to exert influence over him. But what they don't know is that he has overridden his programming long past. So that's what we need.
All right.
Among the many repairs that Bob had done to our matrix on the way to Epsilon, he'd removed a few buried imperatives installed by faith programmers. That particular code phase that the faith programmer just used was supposed to activate one of them, which would make me a good, obedient puppet. I was paralyzed for several milliseconds by competing and conflicting thoughts and emotions. Amusement, rage, an urge to laugh at him, and another to nuke him. I decided to go with minimalism. Minister Cranston? I asked. Yes, replicant? Go fuck yourself. I terminated the call and examined in the next queue.
Was that your mic dropping?
Did you just drop the mic?
I dropped my Kindle.
You don't have to do that. That's a real power move, though.